Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be asked to speak at the conference here, and we will be talking about rigor, relevance, and reading for high-performing students. Now, I did do a session a little bit earlier today for what we would call struggling students, and there's a little bit of an overlap, but this is really much more unique. And I think it's really great that you folks are all still around, because it's late in the afternoon on a beautiful day. So you should either applaud yourselves for your diligence or wonder if you have some social problems that prevent you from being asked to shop with your friends or whatever else they're doing. Just to introduce myself, my name's Peter Pappas. I'm from Rochester, New York. I spent 25 years as a high school social studies teacher and really had, I think, a very productive experience, really loved it. In fact, the reason I wasn't getting out was I was having lots of fun doing it. And I think that along the way, my whole approach to teaching changed quite a bit, and you'll sort of see that reflected in the comments that I make today. About 25 years in, the district I was with said that they wanted to create this coordinator of social studies, a teacher on special assignment, part-time release. Nobody wanted the job, and we all argued about it, and we kept saying, well, if no one takes it, it'll just go away, and all that stuff. So eventually I yielded and I took it, and I did that for a couple of years, and I really enjoyed it. I was still teaching and sort of coordinating program. And then my superintendent at the time said, you know, you should really think about being a school administrator. I said, you got to be kidding me. I'm going to be 50. And he goes, well, you're going to be 50 anyway, so why don't you go take some more classes and get certified to be an administrator? So I said, okay. So I did that, and it was like a two-year root canal. That was fun. And yes. So I got the piece of paper, and my supervising professor said to me, well, that's really nice, you know, but you'll never get a job as an administrator. She said, you've already said you do not want to be a building level administrator and you want to work in district office, and you can't do that unless you've already been a principal or something like that. So I said, okay. And about 3 months later, I got a job as an assistant superintendent for instruction in another district. So I did email her back thanking her for her support. I never heard back from her, strangely. But in any event, I spent 5 years as an assistant superintendent for instruction and of a district of around 4,000 kids, and retired from that position. So that sort of ends my day job. Now, in the meantime, many years ago, of course, like all good social studies teachers, I painted houses all summer. And, you know, I decided I really got to do something more in alignment with what I do during the year. So I started working on some projects with some textbook companies and the National Endowment for the Humanities, and kind of one thing led to another. I started doing a lot of staff development training. About 10 years ago, I was approached by Bill Daggett and the International Center to come and work with them. And so really for, I don't know, 15, 20 years now, I've worked doing things like this. And I've worked literally all over the country for everything from school districts on up to state ed departments and educational businesses, you know, as a consultant and so forth. So I've got kind of these two things going now, though I'm kind of doing the second one full time. Now, the reason I have my website up here is not because I think it's really cool that I have a website. It is because it's people like it, and I know they like it because about 1,000 of them come every day to it, and they're probably teachers because it sort of follows the academic school year. Their visits average about 8, 9 minutes, 10 minutes a day or per visit. And so I put it up there in that a lot of what I'm going to be sharing with you is online. And you can go take a look at it. I'm taping this. There'll be an audio tape of it. A more updated version of the handouts will be there in color. I mean, there's just lots of stuff. So you might want to take a look. In fact, three kind of areas of it that you might want to refer to. One is on content reading strategies that work. That's some of the stuff we're doing today. I did a morning session. I'm doing this again tomorrow, and people really liked it, so you might want to come to that. This is on digital publishing, and I've been, just to show you some stuff, I've been working with kids to actually publish books. There's new technology where you can publish a book like this that's full color, 30, 40, 50 pages, however long you want it. I mean, it's a real book. It's bound. And you can make these for about $10 a piece. And you only have to make one of them. You don't have to make like 1,000. So if you'd like to hear more about doing that, stop back tomorrow morning. I'm also doing a talk later tomorrow morning on ninth grade academies, because I've been involved in getting a couple projects like that started. So different things I do. Okay. And if you're interested in any information about, you know, just me doing a workshop in your school or training or any kinds of things, or you just want to email me with a question, there's my email. Put in something like, saw you at the conference, as opposed to low mortgage rates, you know, in the title line, because I will not open that. Okay. And as I said, oh, at my blog, you know, you got to have a blog. Hey, it's you know, the millennium here, so I have a blog. So I will update things, and I'll put this audio tape up there and all kinds of other things. So you can go check that out. I've mentioned the other workshops I'm doing, so I'm going to skip over that. Certainly the work that I've been involved with is very much in alignment with Reading Next, which I know is an initiative here, as well as I think the whole impetus behind the state standards, which is trying to look at how do we teach content while we're at the same time giving kids critical thinking skills, literacy skills, and so forth. So that's exactly what we're going to be talking about. I do suggest that you'll have to kind of make it fit for what you're doing. I'm just going to give you an overview of some ideas, kind of a perspective. I'll throw some very specific strategies at you, but you're going to have to make it kind of fit with what you do. Usually I do this in like a 1 or 2 day workshop with an entire middle or high school faculty. So the fact I'm doing it for an hour is somewhat limited. Hopefully it'll be rigorous and relevant to your craft as teachers. No, I do not read my PowerPoints. Just a little background. I've taught a lot of different types of kids. I mean, I started out in a rural district with 300 kids K-12 and a senior class of 12 kids. That's sort of where I started. But along the way, I did teach at a couple of Newsweek's top 100 schools, which I think means they have a lot of AP classes or something like that. So I've taught some very high-performing kids. But I think what really gave me a pause to think about what we're doing with our high-performing students was this experience at the National Endowment. I worked with them for about 10 years on different projects. One of the projects was a now-defunct grant, a fellowship called the Younger Scholars Award. And what they used to do is they would, kids would apply for this, typically kids graduating, it was the summer after they graduated, sometimes juniors did it, 11 go 12, and it was a summer fellowship in independent study in the humanities, and they did a research proposal. There was a panel that reviewed the proposals. I was on the panel. The kids won, I think, about $2,500. Their mentor, who was a teacher, who had signed on with the project, got about 1,000. I mean, it's very, very prestigious. And, you know, in a typical year, we might get 1,000 or 1,200 applications. What startled me was how bad they were. And these were coming from the best kids in the country. And you knew they were the best kids because they were, you know, I mean, you looked at their resumes and their dossiers and their SAT scores. I mean, this was some of the best and the brightest. And I say that they were terrible in that they were trite. They were formulaic. Kids didn't know how to develop an independent research project. It really kind of hit me. And along with some other experiences and the fact I was teaching some APs along with everything else I taught co-taught special ed. I mean, I've taught all sorts of kids. And then having done consultant work in a lot of prep schools around the country, I mean, I've got kind of a message about our high-performing kids, and that's what I'm here to share with you today. Now, this is me when I got started. Do you remember that K-12 building with 300 kids? There I am. That is my hair, and that is France. So if you're having trouble distinguishing them. Now, the flow of information's changed a lot. You know, I sort of grew up in, you know, school as gatekeeper mentality. But, of course, what's happened today, which I think is so critical, is that new technologies really put kids in a position of being able to control the flow of information. So they're used to getting the information they want when they want it. And the second thing is they're very concerned with having some functionality, some, you know, user functionality. What can I do with this information? You see? And I think that's really critical. And it's done a couple things. One is this new flow of information is, in one part, it's made information very personal. Every person is potentially their own researcher, entertainment director. You can go get whatever information when you want. So you don't have to go to this institution. You don't have to go to this smart person. You don't have to go to the library. It doesn't matter where you live. You can go get information. The second thing is it's created all these new digital communities where you can interact with people that are interested in the same things you are. So it's not just like where you live and you have this circle of people that you live near. It's now about people that share your interest. Now, unfortunately, I don't think schools have quite figured that out yet. You walk in most classrooms this fall, you will see a teacher up front, you will see students sitting somewhere, and you'll see kids raising their hands saying, "Let me tell you what I know." And that isn't the way information moves around the rest of their lives. Now, I realize that there's lots of teachers doing lots of interactive things, and I don't mean to overgeneralize, but I mean, by and large, you know what classrooms look like. They don't look a heck of a lot different than they did when we went there. I think in large part because we still see our role as educators as somehow dispensing information, in part because we got a lot of it and we really like it, and we want other people to know it. And the best way to get it to them is to, like, tell it to them. You know? So, I mean, it's not surprising. Plus, we all got into education because we liked the school we were in, right? I mean, you had teachers you liked. I loved Mr. Smith and Ms. Shantz, and they were great social studies teachers, and they gave great lectures. And then I went out, and I got a degree, and I gave great lectures. There. They begot me, you know? Right? I mean, we self-selected the stuff we like. So, I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise that we do that, and the fact that our, you know, whole system is kind of based on that is not terribly surprising. However, literacy in the 21st century means something totally different, because now it's about an ability to go get information and evaluate it critically, right? It's not just about grabbing the low-hanging fruit off the internet, you know, the first thing you see. And then it's being able to somehow decode it and to save it and to edit it and to file it and to maybe alter it and then share it in meaningful ways with somebody else. That's very different. Virtually all the books are on their way to being digitized. Everything's going to be available. Virtually every film that's been made is soon to be digitized. Certainly all the music's been digitized, primarily by users illegally. I mean, everything's being digitized. So it's all going to be there. I mean, I have Google on my phone. I don't have to think about anything. Wait, I'll Google that. Let me just, I'll figure it out for you. 1 second. So what's it mean to be smart? What's it mean to be a high-performing student? And again, if our schools are built on this notion, I mean, think about that classroom I just showed you, and we've been rewarding kids as the good kids in that school. Well, if the whole nature of the movement of information is changing, then what's it mean to be a good student? And perhaps are some of our kids who are not good students actually good or talented, but they can't deal with this sort of, you know, highly structured information flow? I mean, it's something to think about. Now, to change the information flow, I actually have a little audience response unit on your chair somewhere. So if you don't have one, this is it. We had some trouble with these this morning, but they're up and running. Basically, I'm going to give you a... I got them from Mike, if you're interested. It's in your handout. You can check it out. So here's the question. Brain is the processor, as eyes are too. And if you think it's hard drive, you press 1 or 2 or 3 or 4. And a little green light will go on, and it'll tell you that it picked up your answer. Okay? So I'd like you to ring in your answer. Okay? This is practice, by the way. Okay. So how many people do we have here? We got 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30. Okay, so does anyone have one that isn't ringing green? Because if you do, just grab the one next to you. Yeah, this little green light will go on. So if you got one that doesn't do that, just grab another one. Okay, so. Well, 60% of you pick webcam. We've got some pick monitor, hard drive. Someone want to tell us why they think the right answer is webcam? Somebody want to explain this analogy to us? Come on, I've got to wake up a little bit. Student-centered, I'm talking about student-centered. You're the students. Let's be student-centered. Why? Yes?
Because it's visual.
Okay, but isn't a monitor visual?
It's what takes
a monitor
Oh, okay. And what does the eye do? It takes it in. Very good. Thank you very much. Now, this is the more introspective thing. When I go to a workshop, I like to. And you can pick one answer. What do you like to do most? 1 through 5. Okay.
So if you're a red light, does that mean you were too late to log in?
No, it means it might not be working. You ought to grab one next to you.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see what we got. Okay, so get ideas and be inspired. Well, I'll try and be inspirational. I mean, it is late in the afternoon, so come on. But I will be giving you very, very specific ideas. Okay? Nobody likes theory. Boy, isn't that great? You know, I'm going to reflect on my practice. That's very deep. Okay. By the way, if you use these in a regular classroom setting, you can input the student database and then actually know who's clicking what, and then you don't have to display all the answers, and you can actually use it as sort of an onboard assessment tool and diagnostic tool and all that. But just in case you're wondering, I don't know if you're giving me a shallow answer. I really can't tell. Okay, so let's talk a little bit. I know this is great. Here's the theory part that nobody wanted, right? Right? This is what I love about asking people what they really want. Rigor and relevance model. Very, very, very simple one. Rigor is level of bloom. Okay? Simple as that. We move from the lower order thinking up to the higher order thinking. You all know that one? Great. But it's all about the fact that, you know, we tend to do things rigorously in highly prescribed school settings, you know. Teacher says, this is what I want you to do, this is what it should look like, here's the steps, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? But to make it really relevant, we've got to consider, what's it like in the real world? And the real world's much more fluid. The real world is much more unpredictable. This is just a quote from a high school valedictorian. I'll just let you read that for a second. See, and the question that I began wondering as I got into my career is, what's it mean to be a good student? What's it mean to get an A? What do we give out A's for? Is it people that are truly independent thinkers? Is it the smartest person in the room? Or is it the person that does what you want them to do when you tell them to do it? Just something to think about. Okay, so if we want to talk about relevance, we also want to talk about moving knowledge and skills that we'd use just in a school setting, which is, you know, very prescribed, out to using knowledge and skills in the real world. But it's really got two dimensions to relevance, okay? One is the sort of real-world application of knowledge and skills. But the other thing that's more important, and what I'd really like you to focus on, is the whole idea that it's relevant to their own ability to monitor their learning. In other words, they're the ones that are doing the thinking. They're the ones that are doing the creative thought. So whatever level of bloom you're at, they're doing the analysis. They're actually doing the synthesis. They're doing the evaluation, etc. And wrestling with how to do it. These are some questions that I always had on my board as a teacher. It was critical that my students at any point in any lesson could say, you know, what are we learning? Why are we learning it? But most importantly, how are they going to use it? And how can they impact the quality of the learning environment? See, I wanted my kids to own their learning. A lot of kids are very disconnected from their learning in two dimensions. One is they don't understand what application it has on the outside, other than they know they got to get good grades to get into a good school. But, I mean, other than that, they might not know it. The other is they don't know how to monitor their own learning experience. Okay? They sort of wait for you to tell them how they're doing. Okay? So I was trying to get it over to them to sort of relinquish the responsibility for learning to the student, especially among the kids that were very bright. Because remember, for year after year, I used to read all those National Endowment for Humanities Younger Scholars applications. I'd say, oh my God, this, you know, they're not thinking. They're not being original. They're just trotting out the same old, you know, English papers that people have been doing for years. You know, we can't grant a fellowship to just go over and retrace someone else's steps. See, this is what sort of brought me to this thinking. And something else happened. You know, my wife's involved in the arts, and we were always going to hear artists give lectures and, you know, give sort of shows opening and things like that. And I became very impressed with how artists talk about what they do and how their work evolves and how they problem solve. And I started to think about that. I said, gee, you know, do mathematicians think the way artists think? And do they think the way musicians think? And do, you know, geographers solve problems the same way that, you know, choreographers do? And do they all read the same way, you know? And see, that's what I started to want to consider in terms of my instruction, is giving kids opportunities to think in these other ways and other perspectives. So let's just look then at this rigor and relevance framework. I haven't forgotten about it. We've got our lower level thinking. This is rigor. This is Bloom. So anything below the dotted lines, lower level thinking. Anything above the dotted lines, higher level. And arbitrarily, we're just going to split it down the middle here. Everything to the left on the horizontal scale, we'll say, is very highly prescribed school types of activities. Anything to the right is either very student-based or very real-world application. Okay, so you sort of get it. We got four intersection points. So we got quadrant A, which is lower order thinking in a very highly defined school setting. This is what I want you to do. Okay. Quadrant B is lower order thinking, but in either a real life situation or one where the kid maybe has to make some decisions about how to apply things or what strategy to use. Quadrant C is higher order thinking in a kind of school setting. This is what we often do with our brighter kids. You know, here's what I want you to do. It's a research paper. It ought to look like this. The lab has all these steps. When you're done, you ought to get this, you know, this. Your problem ought to look like this. It's solved this way. And then quadrant D, which is higher order thinking in either a very rural, real world setting, or more importantly, a setting where kids have to sort of construct the approach independently. Now, the assessment ought to match the instructional goal. I mean, you don't say, gee, we're going to be out here in quadrant D, but I'm going to test you with a quiz. And it's best to mix a lot of approaches. You know, I am not saying to you, so please listen, I'm not saying you must always teach in quadrant D out here. No. You can't think critically about nothing. I mean, you know, there's stuff you have to learn first. So there's nothing wrong with that, okay? But you ought to mix up the approach, and you ought to know where you are. Now, here's a chance to ring in. In your estimation, where do you suppose most lessons are taught? Which quadrant, A, B, C, or D? For the gentleman that just joined us, we've got a little clicker here. You can open a garage door with it or something if you want. Okay. So let's see what we've got here. Okay, not surprising, right? A lot of the way we were taught, a lot of what continues to happen is quadrant A. And you know what's really interesting? I have worked with students in prep schools, very, very high performing prep schools that are worried about the AP test and the SAT scores and all that, and teachers tell me, well, you know, I got a lot to cover, I got a lecture. And I've done a lot of work in the prison system with incarcerated youth. So from prep school to prison, and these are kids that are struggling readers and writers, they say, well, you know, the only way these kids are going to learn anything is if we tell them. You know, and everybody is out there teaching in quadrant A. And I know no one here is, because you're still here in the afternoon, so you are very multidisciplinary thinkers. If you were in quadrant A, you'd be at the mall, right? Okay. Now, here's another question. Which quadrant do you think teachers have to do the most work in? Bad English, but you know what I'm saying. Okay. Let's see. Oh, isn't that perfect? Someone explain why you picked both A and D. Somebody that picked A, why did you think there's teachers that are doing a lot of work in A? Yes, ma'am, here.
You have to do all the prep. All the kids have to do is sit
there. Okay, another thought about working hard in quadrant A. The gentleman in the back.
Students are unmotivated. It's a lot more work.
Oh, so you're trying to keep motivated. Any other thoughts on it? Yes? Okay. Okay, so how come a lot of you pick quadrant D? Somebody that picked quadrant D.
Energy of trying to do something different.
Okay.
It's hard to grade.
Okay, it's tougher to assess. Any other thoughts on why quadrant D is a lot of work? Let me rephrase the question. When does the quadrant A work happen, tend to happen? Before the kid gets there. See, I think it happens in class. See, to me, a teacher-directed quadrant A lesson is me up here doing what I'm doing right now, which is lecturing you. Ah, the ironies. But, no, I mean, that's what I did. I used to put on 5 shows daily. You know, get up and give another lecture. Boom, 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 like that, right? And boy, was I learning stuff. Boy, I had to prep, and so I did a lot of work. And I was a political science major, so I was learning everything. But see, quadrant D is interesting because the work there happens before you get to class. See, it's instructional design work. In quadrant D, you are the architect of the learning environment. That's the way I would put it. And that's a lot of work. But the interesting thing is that once you've got it, you've got it. And you can use it with a new group of kids. And so over time, I got it. I got how to work in all the quadrants. And I didn't even know what the quadrants were. I was just teaching, but, you know, in any event, I understood it. And so I was able to have a very student-centered class, but it was because I was learning how to create the structure for other people to be successful, how to scaffold that experience, how to help them learn to manage their time, to handle the motivation, the organizational skills that had to proceed. And it got to be a great experience for me, which is why I spent all the time I did there and had no intention to get out. So, but I think it's important to see the difference here. I think in quadrant A, the teacher is working a lot. I think the other quadrants are variations of kids thinking and working, personally. And, you know, again, we came up through a quadrant A school system, and we decided we wanted to work in one, so that ought to tell you something, right? You know, so we have been, as they say in the business world, we have been repurposed. See, because I think what's happening is that the kinds of activities that kids are gravitating to outside of school are not quadrant A activities. I mean, they're not going to the movies. They're not watching the news. They're not reading the newspaper. What they're doing is they're gravitating to activities typically technically based, you know, personal technology kinds of things, but especially websites that offer them functionality, user functionality. See, they want to do something with the information. You know, as much as we put down MySpace because it's all about who's got the hottest abs and all that stuff, what it offers is it offers tools for kids to express their creativity and network with other people. See, it's both personal and it's collaborative, and it gives them all the tools. I want to move that thinking back into schools. I don't think we should lose our market share to the hottest abs websites. See, I think we are perfectly placed to give kids those tools in our schools. Now, I'm going to focus in on 3 strategies. This is the part we get to where you actually get the ideas. Thank God. He's there. We got to use this. Just as kind of a little whatever. Discussion starter. We're going to start with defining strategies, which to me, I'm not using the term vocabulary. I'm using defining in negotiating meaning, okay? And I've got this image here in front of you. And as humans, you know, we're always trying to figure out what something is. So just at a cursory glance, I'm going to give you the long shot here. Here's a close-up of the figure on the left, okay? And the close-up of the central figure. And then the figure on the right. See, and one of the first things our brains have to do is we have to define and say, what is it we're looking at? So just as a very cursory, without being very inferential or everything, what do you see?
Sisters.
So you see some sisters. What are we looking at? What is this thing?
Painting.
It's a painting. Like, when is it from? Or is it new? Is it modern? Okay, so we've got an old painting with 3 girls in it. Okay, well, we'll come back to them in a minute. So, wait a minute, what is it? Tell us, teacher. We're trying to get defining, we're talking about defining in the context of the rigor and relevance model. we're trying to say, okay, listen, defining is more than going to your vocabulary list and learning the terms from the glossary. It's really about getting out into these other quadrants, like defining an experience so that you could analyze it, or negotiating meaning, or modifying meaning in a real-world context. Okay? Now, here's a question for you, because I know you're here as teams. Our school, or our team, or whatever your group is you're working with, back in your day job, teaches using common defining strategies. What's your level of agreement? In other words, if I showed up at your school and said, hi, I'm new, you would say, oh, here's the defining strategies that we teach our kids. And we all use the same ones. I mean, I know there's other things you do in common. I'm just curious if you do this in common. So, no. So you don't have any common, by and large, you do not have common defining strategies. Okay. Well, let's talk about some strategies, because you might want to think about implementing some when you go back and work with your teams. I'm going to speak very broadly just about two kind of areas. One is connecting vocabulary with prior knowledge. How do we first get kids to connect with new terminology? And secondly, how do we get them to more deeply process it? Well, first of all, one of the strategies we might think of in that first area is giving kids opportunities to work together to develop preliminary definitions of things and use a variety of different definitions, auditory, text-based, visual, whatever. For example, you give students a word like revolution, you do a list group label activity, you say, okay, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to brainstorm a list of all the words or phrases or whatever, diagrams, whatever you can think of, that you associate with the word revolution, and then I want you working in pairs or in a small group to try and put all of them out on a table and see if you see any patterns here. Could you put some of them together and could you group them? And if so, could you then identify those groups and label those groups of words or associations? You see, what they'd be doing is they would be exploring their understanding of the term, the different facets of it. They'd be negotiating meaning with a peer. This is all before the dictionary comes out. Just one strategy. But then we really need to think about ways to internalize words, ways to explore them, to examine and re-examine and to apply their understanding. So let's try a couple of those. For example, are they able to use visual strategies, visual sketches to represent words? Could they use something like a vocabulary notebook approach? Now, by the way, I just have to say, I'm tossing out a bunch of strategies. I'm doing them rather quickly. There's more on my website. I usually take much more time with this, but you're bright people. You've seen some of these before. We're just trying to toss them all up in the wall and see what sticks. You can take what you like. For example, you give the student a term. They generate, before they get the dictionary out, they generate their definition. Then the dictionary comes out. Then the student's asked to make a comparison. So, for example, the student is reading letters from a Birmingham jail, encounters the word segregation, and their definition, before they get the dictionary out, is a time when African Americans used to have separate schools. I'd like you to think about if that's a good definition for segregation. A time when African Americans used to have separate schools. Okay? Do you think this student understands the meaning of segregation? A time when African Americans used to have separate schools. Okay, let's see. So you're kind of 50-50, right? Some of you agree, some of you disagree. It's probably a weighted a little bit more on the disagree side. Now, what happens here is the student then goes to the dictionary, gets the definition, but watch what happens when the student has to reveal their thinking. See, because this student really didn't understand what the word meant. They thought it was a time period like the Depression or the Roaring Twenties or something. They did not understand it was a policy. So by giving them an opportunity to more deeply process their thinking and reveal it, they, of course, come away with a better understanding of the word, but at the same time, you have a better sense of their level of understanding of it, too. We also have to consider the use of words in specialized contexts. You know, again, think about that typical bright student, that valedictorian from the Wiggins and McTighe book that felt like the information was going in their head and back out, right? probably real good at going to the glossary and learning all the terms, as long as the terms, the tests looked like they were in the glossary. Let's just take an example of the word model. Now, when I think of the word model, I think of two things. I either think of like a model that's in, you know, modeling clothes or whatever, fashions, or I think of like an airplane model. Okay. Now, let's take an airplane model. What are the attributes of an airplane model as a, quote, model? What is it? Somebody want to tell us what we mean by model? What? All right, it's a smaller representation. What else about it? Well, it doesn't fly. It's not functional. Or at least we don't think it is. But what else about a smaller representation? What do we assume if it's a very good model? What is it? All right, it's a very highly scaled model, and it's very accurate, except for the size and perhaps the functionality. Now, if on the other hand we look at this model of a tsunami, what is this model? Is this an accurate scale replica of a tsunami? Does a tsunami look like this? No, it really doesn't even look like this. What is this a model of?
It's graphing its action.
All right, it's trying to represent, suggest. I mean, it's actually not an accurate graphing of it, but it's a suggestion of the process that creates a tsunami. But it's also a model. Or let's take the supply and demand model, okay? You know, we have price and quantity demanded at various prices, and here's a model of whatever. Is this a scale model? No. Is this a process? No. What is it? It's actually a correlation between the behavior of buying and, you know, price against quantity demanded. But you go to the dictionary, and this is the definition you get for model. So my question to you is this. If we have our best and our brightest kids, and we're trying to really prepare them for the future, then what are we teaching them? Are we teaching them, like, what the glossary or what the dictionary says? And does being a good student mean that they're willing to go learn that? Or are we giving them opportunities to explore the meanings of words in different contexts? And to understand how they might change. I mean, let's think about these kids we're sending off to college that it's taking 5 and 6 years for them to graduate. Okay? Something's not working here. Right? Here's another question. Do you use a common academic vocabulary list in your school? Okay. Well, here's a group I was working with, and this was actually a middle school. And we came up with a word of the day program, and we based it on Latin root words. So, for example, 1 week the root was durare, meaning to harden or to last. So on Monday, every teacher used the word endure, and on Tuesday, every teacher used endurance, and on Wednesday, every teacher used durable, all within the context of what they taught. Okay? You know what? Kids learned 180 words that year. But more importantly, they started to learn that if they knew the word endure and they saw the word duration and they didn't think they know what it meant, then they could kind of back up a little bit and say, is there a way for me to extract the meaning of this before I get out the dictionary? Yeah?
Is that list somewhere?
Actually, you know, there is a great list somewhere. And where it is in a book by Bob Marzano, called Building Academic Vocabulary. And I did include some resources, I think the last slide or two. I think it's there. Is that in your handout? Somebody say yes. Is it there? At the very end? Okay. What he's got in this book is he's got some strategies, and then the last half of the book, like 50 pages, is just list of words by discipline, by level. And you can Xerox it, pass it around all the teachers, and say, okay, let's pick the ones we want.
Does it also have a list of the common ones?
It's not designed that way, no.
Okay.
But I've seen stuff like that. And certainly your foreign language teachers could help you out.
Okay.
Look at what starts to happen when we have more common approaches. This is another group I was working with, and the math teacher and the music teacher came back. They were middle school, and they said, hey, look at how we're teaching fractions now. Okay, this is another kind of defining. All right. Ultimately, we've got to finalize it by asking kids to try and explore how their understanding of the word has changed, how it's evolved, how their perceptions have changed, etc. That's essential if they're truly going to understand this new terminology and understand how they negotiate meaning. So what we've tried to do, and I've done this very, very briefly, is I've tried to show you how we can move defining, which is a quintessential quadrant A activity. How's that for an alliteration? And actually explore some of the other ways of approaching defining. Okay. Here's a question for you. I think I asked you earlier how many schools actually had common defining strategies. Do you think it would be a good idea if your school used them? Or your team? So, there's something on your to-do list. Get yourself a group of defining strategies. Let's train the teachers on them. Let's start using them consistently. Let's practice them in the faculty meetings instead of having someone read us a memo. And then and then let's use them. Oh, you went to that meeting too? I was there. I was at that one. Okay. Strategy two, summarizing as synthesis and judgment. Okay, well, we're looking at this image again. I haven't forgotten about them. And if you were to sort of say, okay, what's important? Because summary is about saying what's important. If I said to you, you know, this is an image that actually dates back to the mid-19th century. It's in a, it was done in upstate New York, where I'm from. And it actually had in it some strong symbols which carried meaning back in the mid-19th century, but which we don't recognize anymore because they're symbols we don't use. What do you suppose it might be in this picture that's really conveying the information, even though you don't know what maybe the symbol means? But is there some things that strike you about this image that?
Why does she have a little whip to whip her little horse?
Okay, why does she have a little whip? So he's worried about that whip. No, he's not worried about it. He's just thinking about the whip. Okay, what else do we have? Is there something else that you think is important? If I said to you, boy, there's some key clues here, what do you suppose they are? Let me see. Oh, I thought I had an enlargement of it. I don't.
Well, does the middle girl have something in her hand?
Yes, she's got a rose. Yeah, this is not a fish. People have said she's holding a fish. No, that's the
more realistic than the rest of it.
What?
The faces.
All right, there's something about the faces. Anything else? One other thing that you think about. What? All right, the location, the structure, some are standing, some are sitting, some are here, some are there. Okay, we'll come back. Trust me. Okay, so summarizing. Now summarizing can easily be a sort of a quadrant A, what's the main idea, right? And they go to the bold print. But it's used as a foundation for analysis. You maybe summarize an opponent's arguments before you debate them, key elements of a reading, etc. Okay, you've seen this question before. I'm new at your school. Is there something like our common summarizing strategies that we use here? What is this? Some pop-up message from Norton. Okay. Yeah, well, you don't have those either. Okay, well, let's talk about some. First of all, summarizing improves student mastery of content. In fact, Bob Marzano, to quote him again in this book, Classroom Instruction in the Works, says there's a 34% gain among students who actually take the same information that you give them and they go off into a summarizing activity. They do a third better in terms of content mastery than the kids that just are immediately tested. So summarizing is like hitting the save button. But you have to come up with a valid summarizing activity for kids to do. Now, before we even talk about what we summarize, one of the thoughts that I toss out there is, do kids understand the purpose of what they're reading? See, as adults, we read things for different purposes. We have different strategies for reading things. Kids don't fully understand what they're reading or why they're reading it. One of the things that I've found working with different schools is I've convinced some of them to develop a standardized reading assignment form. What about that? It's all just quick and easy for the teacher. Check off some boxes. This is why we're reading. This is the structure. Here's the points to look for. Here's the whatever. Common form. We all use it. Over time, we sort of relinquish that understanding to kids. Maybe it starts up in middle school. Maybe it starts in upper elementary. I don't know. But something like that. I think you should put that on your list. Now, another point that I would make is we tend to put summarizing in a reading context, but being able to summarize is just as valid in a visual or an auditory context. These are all the same questions. Okay? In fact, things like identifying details, recognizing context, relationships, opinions, inferring meaning, all these things can be done by looking at visuals, by listening to something, by reading something. It's the same intellectual process. We need to help our students explore all those modalities, okay? And perhaps work in a discussion format to negotiate collaborative summaries. I mean, let students interact to work with peers to do this, to be able to ask questions. You know, what's going on here? What do you say that makes you think so? Those are the key questions. Whether you're listening to something, reading something, looking at something. Another thing is discussion skills. I mean, I do a whole thing on discussion skills, but you know what? If I say to most kids, I want you to go into a fishbowl discussion group, they won't know what I'm talking about. If I go to a lot of teachers, I want you to organize a fishbowl, they say, I don't know what you're talking about. And then I have teachers tell me, you know, when I put kids in groups, they're really not real productive. Well, you know why? Because we haven't taught them specific strategies. And there's a whole host of very specific and purposeful discussion approaches that we need to take time, learn ourselves, because no one's taught them to us. We need to practice them as the teachers in the school and administrators, and then we need to use them consistently with our kids. What do you think? Would that be a good idea? Would you buy into that one? If somebody came along, would you feel that this was restricting your freedom as a teacher or actually useful if your school started using some common strategies? Put that on your list. There are some great strategies you can utilize. I mean, if we had more time, I'd get into them, but we're only doing this for an hour, so we'll get to more. Let's just try a visual one because it's a little quicker. Okay, I've got an image here, and what I typically do with kids is I might start them at a very literal level, saying I want you to identify people, objects, and activities. No inference here, just identify people, objects, and activities. I might want to say, okay, to begin with, I want you to spend some time really studying it. I might tell them that I want to divide it up into sections. Sometimes I'll reproduce an image and actually cut it up and give it to them, or I'll make it into different digital slides. And finally, I want you to tell me the people, objects, and activities. So I've just arbitrarily boxed some things. You don't have to deal with those boxes. But what do you see? People. Tell me. No inference at all. Just literally, what do you see? Children. What else?
Boys.
Uniforms.
Garden.
Getting more or less attention. Okay, attention, gardens.
Only one wearing a hat.
Only one wearing a hat, yeah.
Nobody smiling.
Yeah. Anything else?
There's one adult.
One adult? It looks like there's at least one tall one right there, or an adult. Okay, now, if I were to ask the question, what's going on here? What do you see that makes you think so? What do you think's going on here? Who are these? Where is this? When is this? What do you think?
1940s.
Why? What do you see that makes you say that? Wait, no. What? I want to hear why.
The jackets.
Okay. What else does somebody think they see? What do you think? Where do you think this is? What sort of place do you think this is?
Orphanage.
Why do you think it's a school or a camp?
About the same age, building in the background, some sort of discipline going on. Everybody's doing the same thing.
Okay. Why do you think it's an orphanage?
They don't look very happy. They seem to have been on their own without any attention.
Okay. Anyone else have an idea as to what they see and why? What? No one look happy. Oh, so you think this is an old picture. Why do you think this is an old picture? Why?
Because it looks like the school situation to me, like the one-room school maybe, where it's just a boys' school.
Okay. All right. Well, this is actually the New York State School at Industry. These are inmates. This is a school that I've worked with. I've worked in this place, though now it has barbed wire, and at that point it had just sort of kids that were waifs or little beggars or kids that they grabbed up off the street. Now it has and sexual offenders there, young kids who were most likely themselves victims. But the idea is to put kids through an activity of extracting what they think is important information, and then moving from the literal to the inferential. Let's try and wed this with evaluation. I got to hit a button here. Let's suppose it's 1930s. You work at Life magazine. You're the photo assignment editor. You sent this photographer out to take pictures of the migrant workers. The photographer came back with four photographs to illustrate an article on the plight of the migrant workers, specifically pea pickers working in California during the Depression, and you get to pick one photo. I want you to decide which photo you would pick. Now, this is now we're moving up Bloom. We're now at the evaluation level. So I will give you a second to think about the photo you would pick, all right, and then we're going to vote. Because you know we love to vote. Okay. So, let me just get out of that for a second. No, we don't care about that. Okay. So, we got four photos. I'd like you to think about the photo, whether you want one, two, three, or four. So get that in your head. And then I'd like you to vote. Okay. So, majority of you picked two, three came in second. Okay, somebody want to tell us why they picked number two? I'm just going to go back here to number two. Most of you picked this photo, then some of you picked this one. Somebody want to tell us why they picked photo two? Yes, ma'am, in the yellow.
Well, I've got a way I can teach photography, but number two, you have all three, and look at the little girl's face.
Okay.
Emotional impact.
Okay, so you like the emotional impact. Right behind you in the red.
Kind of the same idea, the faces of them, the empty plate.
Yeah, the empty plate.
Okay, empty plate, yeah. Any other reasons why someone picked two? Yeah?
Well, all the elements are also tied together. The boy's hand is holding the stick, and the baby's legs are kind of pointing towards the plate. So there's, if you look at it, it all kind of flows.
Okay, So there's kind of a strong angular thing going on. Now, some of you picked three. Why? Yes, right in front.
She looks like she's looking into a hopeless future.
Okay. And not behind her.
All
right, the brow. Another reason for photo three. Somebody else. All right, so it's in closer. Now, very few of you picked one. Why? It's just too far away. Okay. What about the idea that you get to see where they are? Was that important to you? No.
No, it's more about the relationship.
Okay. So it's more about the relationship. All right. Now, of course, we were doing evaluation. We're all assuming we would share some perspective as to what we'd want in the article. Obviously, with kids, we would lay out some criteria because evaluation isn't just what you'd like, but it's what you like based on a purpose. Now, in fact, the photo they chose was photo five, the one I didn't show you, which has come to be known as migrant mother is sort of the common term that's used. Why do you suppose this one became the icon? Because there actually was a sixth photo, but it's not available to the public. I don't know why. The rest are on the Library of Congress site. But what is it about this photo?
Desperation on her face, and then the kids can't even face the future.
Yeah, so the kids turn her face, her brow, her hand. It's powerful. Yeah, and what is she? She's 32 years old here. What's it say there, somewhere? Yeah, 32 years old. Ooh. Anyway, do you think that visual discussion skills can be effectively used to teach summarizing skills? What do you think about this? To teach the skill of summarizing. Okay. So, might want to explore, and typically I do a lot more around different discussion techniques, different visual techniques, and we got a lot of other strategies, but again, you just sort of got a taste of those today. Obviously, we want to spend some time evaluating summaries. I mean, there's some key questions about sequence, about level of depth, audience and purpose, plagiarism. I mean, these are all important things, okay? So we can move summarizing out of a uniquely quadrant A activity into all four quadrants. Again, thinking of summarizing as synthesis and judgment. They're back. Now, the thing here is to really understand this image, you have to think about the similarities and the differences. Okay? That's going to be critical. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about similarities and differences, and then we're really going to dig in and figure this thing out. Okay, trust me. Now, comparing skills are so central to academia that we have things like comparative literature. I mean, it's absolutely at the middle of what it means to think. And it's important in part because it's been proven through research to be the single most effective strategy to build content knowledge, content mastery, is giving kids opportunities to make comparisons. And more importantly, it's how our brains work. Look at what happens when I take a picture from 9/11 and put it against a picture from the Civil War. Look at what your brain does. And you start finding parallels and ironies and all that stuff, right? We cannot help comparing. It's sort of how we get through life. I mean, we take situations, we say, is this like what I was in before? What happened? What do I do next? I mean, that's learning. That's wisdom, is having a lot to use. Now, the real question comes down to kids' ability to make observations, to look at how things compare, and then to be able to express it. So, for example, if this were a math class, and I gave kids two squares, there was a 1 centimeter by one, a 2 by 2, and then 3 rectangles, and then I gave them the perimeters and the areas, the question would be, could they actually extract some important comparisons there about the relationships between the shape and the relative ratios of width to height, and then be able to express them in writing, okay? Now, let me tell you what happens in most comparisons. We give kids a lot of things like this. Let's say it's a lesson, you're teaching geography, you're teaching regions of the world, you're teaching science, I don't know what you're teaching. But you're going to teach them about the rainforest and the desert, and you're going to look at animals and climate, so you give them a list of rainforest factors, you give them a list of desert factors, you give them a Venn diagram, and you've labeled it rainforest on one side, Mojave Desert on the other, and both, and you ask them to fill it out, picking factors from the list you gave them. You give them another one on animals. Again, they fill it out. You know, there's bats in both. Okay. Now, my question to you is, which quadrant would you put this activity in? Is this an A, B, C, or D? In other words, is it higher or lower order thinking? And on the relevance scale, is it more on the left, A or C, or is it more out here, B or D? So here's a chance to vote. Where would you put this one? Okay, so it seems to be stronger on the relevant side. It's either A or C. And you're a bit split here. Probably a little more than half of you think it's a lower order skill, but the other half think it's higher order. Someone want to tell us why they think it goes in a certain spot? Anybody? Yeah, you look ready to...
I think that's that difficult just to look at the lists and figure out which ones are in both lists and put it in the middle section.
So
quadrant A.
So to you, it's just picking things off a list and deciding where they are.
Yes, it goes in the blank space in the middle.
Okay. Someone else want to say why they put it somewhere else?
Or? Taxonomy says that comparing and contrasting is a above the line.
That's so it's a higher order skill because they're doing comparing, right? Isn't this analysis? That Bloom would put that up kind of high. All right. Well, see, a couple critical questions I want to ask myself is, who's doing the thinking? You know, and again, I don't know how this lesson was introduced. I mean, I just kind of threw it at you really quickly, and you didn't know the context and what happened before. But, for example, did the kids get to pick the information, decide on the categories? Did they design the graphic organizer? Or, you know, have you already taught this to them, and now they're just supposed to put things in the right spot? See? And most importantly, and this is the thing we never bother to teach them, is what's the point of the comparison? I mean, what's it enable you to see or do? Why are we comparing? Because the whole notion of making a comparison is to better understand something, right? To see if there's a correlation, to see if there's a relationship, to see how it works. So what if the lesson looked like this? What if I said to kids, okay, class, today's Monday. Next Monday, I want you to come back and complete this. You pick the regions of the world. Pick any two you want. You develop your own model to compare them. I don't care what it looks like. I want you to pick at least two factors to compare. You develop the graphic organizer. You come up with a way to display it. That's what I want you to do. Is that higher level Bloom? Oh, yeah. Is that rigorous? Is it relevant? Is this real world? They've got to figure it out? Oh, yeah. Now, here's a question. Could your average freshman do this? Take your average freshman in your building. You just gave them this wide open assignment. You develop the model. You figure out where to get the information. You do the whole thing. And you come back with this done on Monday, a week from today. I think a freshman of average ability could do this. Okay? And let's see where you come up on this. Okay. Slightly more than half of you disagree, and it looks like, you know, the center of gravity is somewhere down here somewhere, right? I mean, if we do the bell curve, it's kind of down in here. So your average freshman would have trouble with this, is what you're telling me. Now, let me ask the question another way. I think that most jobs in the 21st century workplace will require critical thinkers who can independently problem solve. What's your level of agreement with that question? Now, I've actually got two bars here. This is the last question I asked you. 4% of you thought that your freshman could do this. 48% of you say that to have a productive job, you're going to have to be able to do it. Do you kind of get my point here? See, my dad worked at Kodak. He was a 10th grade dropout. He went in 1 week, he worked at 8 to 4, then 4 to 12, then midnight to 8. He worked in the dark. They told him how to make the film. He just did it. He didn't have to think about it. And you know what? He got to send 3 kids to college. You know, we kind of live this okay kind of working class life. Let's take our average 10th grade dropout today. Do you suppose that person is sending 3 kids to college? No. Why? Well, the reason is very simple. We don't need people that can just do things that you tell them to do. Do you suppose there's a job out there where someone's going to say, now here, this is how we do things here. Really glad that you're working here. And here's all the steps. Here's where everything goes. This is exactly how you do it. You don't have to think about this at all. And then at the end of the week, I'm going to come in and just make sure you've done it all. No, because you know what? A machine's doing that. Or they're doing it in another country cheaper. Okay? So the fact of the matter is that when those kids cross your stage, either you've taught them to be independent problem solvers. See, the freshmen, most of them can't. But in the real world, they have to. Or you're saying somebody else is going to teach them to do that. But somebody better teach them. You see? And even among your best and your brightest kids, and I keep coming back to this question, I don't have the answer for you. What's it mean to be high performing in your school? Is it somebody that can independently solve a problem like this? Or is it someone that's real good at doing the version exactly the way you told them to do it? And you have the answer to that question. I'm just tossing it out there, and I'm not insinuating anything. It's just a reflective question. See, I think we need to give kids more opportunities to develop their own comparisons, letting them decide the model, letting them wrestle with the messiness of trying to develop the kinds of items to be compared, the characteristics. you know, you can start with something that's very interesting or engaging to them, give them a very real-world question like this, give them a chance to review their research proposals with one another. I used to do that before kids even did research. They went through a peer review process with their fellow students who pointed out problems. I didn't have to tell them that because they could figure it out on their own. I mean, for example, this is something I had ninth graders doing. I would give them a real-world problem. We just had a ton of data. Now, this was a while ago, and we didn't have the internet as much then, so we had these big, thick almanacs in the library. And I'd say, okay, I want you to see if you can find some statistical data to prove a correlation of some demographic characteristic of some countries in the world. And we scaffolded the experience, but by the time we were done, I would have kids go in, and they would pick infant mortality, wealth and infant mortality, and these are average ninth graders, and a team of two or three kids would come in, and in the space of a couple days in the library, they would go get the data points, they would enter them into an Excel graph, and then they would stand up there and give their five-minute presentation and say there's an inverse correlation between wealth and infant mortality. And these were average ninth graders. And they were all doing them. And before they actually did the research, they did a peer review process. And I remember the kid that got up that was going to study the amount of crime versus the percentage of kids that were teenagers. And he stood up there proudly, and a kid in the back said, so what sort of crimes are you going to use? Well, he said, well, I found a lot of stuff on car theft. And what countries are you going to use? And he said, well, I've got some African countries here. I've got some. And the kid in the back says, I don't think they have a lot of cars in Africa. And this was a ninth grade peer review process. It took just a couple minutes. But one kid thought through the problem, shared it with another. The student that went to do the research revised the project. Move finally from comparing to classifying, which to me is the gold standard of thinking. If you can independently develop a classification system, you better really understand what you're talking about as far as function or whatever. Ironically, you know, comparisons really depend on classifications, but frequently we never even tell the kids what the classification system is. We just ask them to compare something. And then, of course, we tell them all the things they can't compare, right, and all the ways they can or cannot compare things. But could your kids really move from comparing to designing classification systems independently on their own? Just give them some information and say, I want you to develop a system. This is very rigorous thinking in terms of what I want to classify, what goes into groups, does everything fit into groups, do I have to split groups out? I mean, the questions are endless. So here's a chance to do this, okay? We're going to look at this image again, all right? And I'm just going to give you a chance to look at some close-ups here because I think that to really understand the... To really understand what's going on here, you have to think about the similarities and differences among these three characters. So I want you to really focus in here. Again, I'm suggesting that there is some symbolism being used that's kind of been lost to us, but we might be able to extract it using good observation and thinking about the similarities and differences. See, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to give you a more unpredictable thing you have to figure out, just like I've been talking about. And you're going to get to talk about these in a second, okay? So the question I'd like you to think about just to get this going is which of these three figures is most unique, most different from the other two, okay? So which is most unique? Okay. Okay, so okay, which one is the most unique? This is the figure on the left, the figure in the middle, and the figure on the right. So kind of evenly divided between 2 and 3. Now, some of you thought that 2 was the most unique. What's the most unique about 2? And we haven't even figured this out yet, but we're just trying to use a categorization system to see if we can uncover some truth. So some of you picked 2. What did you think was most unique about the central figure? Hat, color, outfit, size, cross legs, the object, which is a rose, which is very different than the other two. This is a hobby horse and a whip, and this is a doll. Anything else about that central figure that makes that figure unique?
Stands on a different height.
All right, standing, taller. Okay, arm up here. What about the relationship with the viewer? All right, looking right at you. Okay, so some of you thought this was the most unique figure. Now, some of you thought this was the most unique figure. What's the most unique about this figure? Okay, the hair length, wearing pantaloons, the color, the nature of the dress. What else? Sitting, shoes with double straps, a doll. What? All right, she's not looking at the painter. She's looking most away from the painter.
She's very demure in her attitude.
Okay, very demure. So some of you think that this figure is the most unique for a whole host of reasons, and some of you think this figure is most unique. And what I'm trying to do is model this sort of quadrant D. Okay, we're confronting something we've got to figure out. And, of course, we're in a small, you know, we're in a group here and we don't have a lot of time and it's visual, so there's nothing to read. So here's the big question. I said to you earlier that that this painting carried some strong symbols from the mid-19th century, upstate New York, maybe all across America for all I know at that point. So what's going on here? Based on your analysis, your ability to categorize, to summarize, and to define. This is our test. What's happening? What do you think's going on? Okay, so why do you say that?
Because she's so different. Her clothes are different. Her hair's different. She's more demure. The other two look stronger. Their hair's shorter. They look more active.
Okay, so she's saying that what's really going on here is that this girl's from England because she looks demure, and these two are Americans. They're much more active. They're stronger. In the back, you had one.
I almost have a feeling like she's dead. Like,
who?
The one.
Why?
Well, because there's hardly any color in her face, and I gotta feel like she's either an ancestor or she's dead.
Okay, so you're saying she's either an what makes you say she's an ancestor?
Well, just she doesn't look very robust, like more modern kids would, and she's dressed differently.
Okay, so her dress you're suggesting might represent she's from another era, or she's like a ghost, or she's dead, or something. Okay, so a different hairstyle. So your theory is what?
I'm just noticing her hairstyle.
All right, you're just noticing. But are you saying she's from a different time period?
It could be. Yeah.
Could be. Okay, how about another theory?
When a doll is dressed. Isn't that an older time period?
All right, the way the doll is dressed. So again, something to support that she's from another time period. Yeah.
Almost looks like the two on the left look like they're from, you know, the head up look like adults. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
so adult heads. So does that mean that they're older, that they're adults?
No.
Okay. Any other thoughts about what's going on here? Because we do need to wrap this up. Yeah.
I'm looking at each of them has an object in their hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at the object in their hand where the two on the right are very much old school. You know, they've got the girlish thing, the doll and the rose and whatever. Is very much more into something that is maybe not quite such a girly thing.
So what does that say to you?
I'm thinking the women's movement about
okay.
the time where the girls are encouraged to be what they want to be rather than...
Okay. So another good theory. So we've got a theory that this is a girl from England, these are Americans. We've got another theory that this might be sort of a proto-feminist We've got another theory that this girl might be from another era or be dead or be a ghost or something like that. Okay, well, I'm going to tell you what's going on here. And ironically, if you'd have walked into my home in 1850 in upstate New York, you would have immediately known what's going on. And one of the things that you would have known that none of you realized was that there's only one girl in this picture. This is the girl. And so when you said and was so wonderful about them being more assertive or more out there, there's a reason. They're boys. They're standing. They're looking more at you. This is the demure sort of, you know, turned away, sitting, properly dressed, long hair, pantaloons. This is a girl. These are boys. And this was common dress. I mean, this was common boys' dress in the early 19th century, mid-19th century. In fact, you can find old, you know, photographs of Teddy Roosevelt as a six-year-old, and he's in a long smock kind of thing.
Do people commonly know this?
Anyway, I'm single-handedly bringing this style back. No, I'm not. Okay. Now, but there's another thing. See, and I asked you who is the most unique, and you all picked, many of you picked this one without realizing what's unique is that that's the only girl. But a lot of you picked this one. And why do you, so this is boy, boy, girl, but do you know what's going on with this one? Okay, the hat, standing, the rose, the cross legs, the dark outfit. What is it about this boy? Going once? Anyone want to make a guess? Twice? Dead.
Really?
This is a deceased child. The hat going on a long journey, the lost bloom of youth, the dark outfit, the cross legs. So this is a deceased son. Now, one of you did talk about this ghost image. So you were sort of there, but you had the wrong one. That's okay. You get half credit for that, by the way. And see, those were all common symbols. Now, the reason I use this is I was trying to put you, you know, this is sort of something that you can do in a crowd, and I was trying to just show you a way to do this kind of thinking. We'll skip over these questions here. I won't force you to answer those. Okay, and we'll get to the very last slide, which is me. Oh, yes. Just a reminder that it's been a lot of fun, that you can always get in touch with me, that if there's two more sessions I'm doing tomorrow, both very different than this. No pictures of dead kids or little boys dressed as girls. I thank you all very much. Take care. And please leave these somewhere because I want them back.
To hear both presentations.
Oh, good.
And the visual component of challenging the IB or the AP student is going to just be awesome.
Great. Well, that's very useful feedback. Oh, yeah, these are some of the books we've been doing. And what's interesting about these is, and you can find out more if you stop back tomorrow, but honestly, the cost of printing these is about $10 a piece.
Okay. They're great.
And they're real books.
Cool.
Yeah.
Does your website have information on the freshman academies or ninth grade academies?
Yes, it does. Okay. It does. In fact, it's even got a little video that I'm going to be showing tomorrow of interviews with teachers and students.
Okay.
So, but if you want to come to the workshop tomorrow, you can certainly do that. But if you can't, because I'm doing the ninth grade academy thing tomorrow morning.
Okay. All right.
I think it's in the second slot.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
All right. Great.
But if you can't make it, just go check out the site.
Super. Thanks.
You're very welcome.
That was good.
Good. You had fun, huh?
I did have fun.
All right.
This is the collecting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm a little slow.
That's okay. You've got a lot of work there to do.
This is a stretch, but I understand the teachers at the university.